there are over 33,000 stolen generation survivors, and 27,200 of those are age 50 and over. And a report released yesterday by the Healing Foundation shows that stolen generation survivors face a gap within a gap, with poorer health and well-being outcomes than other Indigenous Australians who already report poorer health and well-being outcomes than non-Indigenous Australians. Ian Hamm is a Yorta Yorta man and chair of the Healing Foundation's Stolen Generation Reference Group. He was removed from his family at 3 weeks old and adopted to a new family.
I was born in June 1964 and I was separated from my family at 3 weeks of age. I was adopted by a non-Aboriginal couple in September of 1964 and I became Ian Hamm. I was born Andrew James. And in September of 1964, I became Ian Hamm. There's a single piece of paper I have amongst my documents, which I accessed years later when I was in my 20s, where it starts at the top of the page at the child, Andrew James, and it's got, you know, blah, 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 blah. At the bottom of it, it's got, she'll be known from now on as Ian David Hamm. So I've got a single piece of paper, which changes me from one person into another person. That's probably, for me, the single most impactful document I have.
What was childhood like for you? Were you always aware that you had been removed from your family, or what was the story you were told?
Oh, right. So it was adoption at the time. So my adopted mother and dad, they were only told that his name was Andrew James. He's Aboriginal, but he's got some Indian blood in him as well. So other than that, they knew nothing about me. And in terms of being removed or anything like that, that was never discussed with them. And in fact, you know, that was never discussed, I guess, openly by anyone at that stage. It was just these Aboriginal children were available for adoption and people would adopt them. That's what happened. So the idea of forced removal wasn't really something I think most Australians spoke about.
And so when was it that you discovered that this situation had happened to you?
I always knew I was adopted, that I'd been born somewhere else. When I was 19, I found out my story. It took me another 3 years to do anything about it. And even then, it wasn't me that initiated. It was one of my birth sisters who contacted me because they'd heard that they had a little brother. And I met the rest of my family in my early 20s. And then you find out what was going on at the time, what my mother was doing, that I had brothers and sisters, that they were from Shepparton in Victoria. I mean, I grew up in Yarrawonga in Victoria, so Yarrawonga is only 50 kilometres from Shepparton. So I could have gone anywhere in the world, Australia certainly, and I end up 50 kilometres from where I'm from. That was, I won't say shocking, but it was certainly stunning that I'd actually was that close to where I was from, only I didn't know I was from there, and that I was brought up on my own traditional lands, only I didn't know they were my traditional lands until I left. So to find that stuff out in my early 20s, and then go through that stuff of building a relationship with this huge family, because the Jameses are a big family, that I was part of. That was overwhelming at times, is probably the best way to put it. Very large to deal with in your life, trying to find your place. That was how I best describe it. Even now, today, I'm still trying to find my place.
That reconnection, particularly after having so many years lost and living a completely different life, that trying to pick up knowing what you've missed, that really highlights the disconnection, doesn't it? That even though people are willing to reconnect with you, there's so much that really can't be very easily refound because time's gone.
That's right. And I think this is what people don't quite appreciate, is that building sibling relationships, that actually happens when you're kids, not when you're adults. So, but trying to do that when you're adults, it's challenging because you're building family connection and relationships with people you've never met before. For most people, those things happen when you grow up. So my family that I grew up with, my adopted family, that's my family, as is my birth family who I connect with. They're my family too. But trying to build those relationships, it's funny, it's the little things that happen that remind you that you had a different life or you weren't there. In my case, when my brothers and sisters were growing up, I wasn't there. So my cousin's 60th was, I don't know, about 2 years ago, it was a party in Shepparton, it was all there and it was great, it was fantastic, you know. And my family's really good at giving speeches, so a lot of speeches that night. But one of them they were talking about was when they were growing up together, you know, like, you know, they'd get in trouble and they'd jump over the back fence and Pop James would chase after them and stuff. And I wasn't there for any of that. I was in Yarrawonga being Ian Hamm, not with everyone else in my birth family who were being Jameses, you know. And it's little things like that that just reminds you that you're separate. Your place in this family was for a very short time and then a huge absence of over 20 years and then you're still trying to find your place. It's those little things that remind you that you are different to everyone else.
You did grow up on your cultural lands and Yorta Yorta people have a long and deep history in that part of the world. Beyond those human relationships that you were disconnected for that time, what challenges have you had as an adult connecting to that other aspect, that cultural and spiritual yeah. aspect that you also missed out on?
Because I grew up on my country, it was funny, I still remember plain as day as a child growing up, I always just felt, I don't know, an affinity, particularly the Murray River and the bushlands around it, because we used to spend a lot of time down there as kids and stuff. But I just really loved being down there, and I just thought I really loved it because it's a nice place and stuff. And then when I leave, I find out that's my country. That's where I belong. Well, that's where my ancestors have been. And so this country is in my blood. It's not just somewhere I was. It's somewhere I am. It is me as much as I'm it. Trying to build those cultural connections in the absence of having that around you when you're young and then as an adult trying to find your place, not only in your family but in the Aboriginal community per se, in the wider Aboriginal community, and then find how do I fit my cultural identity in this? How do I develop a cultural identity is probably a better way of putting it. And then how do I make that fit in with the rest of me, if that makes sense? That's really difficult, you know. I mean, there's days I feel like, do I feel as Yorta Yorta as I should? Do people think of me as a real Yorta Yorta person? And consciously they do. And they all do. This is something about inside of me, that self-doubt about how Yorta Yorta am I? Am I connected to my country and my community enough? Do I do things that make them proud of me? Do they want me? That's the sort of stuff that I guess is with you every day because of not being there and not having those connections and not having that culture around you when you're young. That's the type of thing that goes into your mind every day. And then you think about, do I almost overcompensate in trying to express my Aboriginality? So, I don't know, somebody might say I've overcompensated in that by the work I do in the community and when I was in government, you know. With that, I look back on that and I think what I've done over the years and how I've done it, is that me trying to prove to myself that I'm Aboriginal or I'm Aboriginal enough? Is that me thinking I have to prove to others that I really belong here when in fact I don't have to do that? But it's kind of something subconsciously for me, trying to prove that I belong, prove that there is a place for me. And that goes across, you know, am I black enough? Am I immersed in my culture enough? Am I connected to my country enough? All of that stuff is still part of me every day now.
And your situation, having been supported to explore and discover and reconnect, to have been found and embraced by your family and have had opportunities to explore it all and to work through this, yours is probably a story that's more upbeat in comparison to some of the people who are stolen generation survivors who still haven't even found their families. And you've just spoken about the emotional and mental distress that you experience as a person who is settled in a community. It must be so terribly tough for people who have experienced a more traumatic experience or not even been able to find those families at all.
Yeah, absolutely. So if I have these self-doubts, and from my situation, the trauma that others went through. Those who were institutionalised, who weren't adopted, for example, but made to live in state homes, you know, or be wards of the state, that kind of stuff. Those who've never been able to find where they're from, or when they go to find people, they're gone, they're dead. I think that's one thing for me which is a hole I still have, is my mother died in 1966 and I would have been 2 years old, and so I never got to meet my mother, you know. That is an enormous vacuous hole in my life that I will never be able to fill. I've got wonderful brothers and sisters. I've got my wonderful adopted mum and dad, but, you know, a woman who gave birth to me. I got a couple of photos of her, and people talk about her and tell me about her and stuff. But I think one of the enormously frustrating things with that is that people say I'm like her in character and temperament, but I'll never know what that means. And for those people who've had a much worse outcome than me, I can't even comprehend the distress they have on a daily life, which probably for me has driven me in what I do and have done for pretty well most of my life, is about what can I do to help uplift the life of Aboriginal people, and in particular, the stolen children like me. You know, what can I do to bring not only just relief to them, but can I help uplift their lives in what I do? So that's why I do what I do.
The Making Healing Happen report that was released by the Healing Foundation this week, it really tries to push home the urgency, necessity for action here. The Stolen Generations population, over 50 identifying as survivors from that, are in excess of 27,000 people. So we've got an ageing population whose families may have passed already, especially that the Bringing Them Home report was released in 1997. Yeah. The urgency must be being felt now.
Oh, the urgency is critical. Out of a population of just over 33,000 who are identifying as stolen generation, over 27,000 are over the age of 50. And a significant amount of those would be over the age of 60 and so forth. We quite simply are running out of time to respond to this community, to provide some sort of recompense to these people for the trauma they have had done to them when they were children and lived with most of their lives. And one of the big issues now facing the Stolen Generations community is the ageing factor. Stolen Generations people are becoming increasing need of access to aged care services and associated services such as disability services and so forth. But those services need to be provided on the terms and in the way that respond to the Stolen Generation. Residential aged care, as we have just seen from a Royal Commission into the aged care system, can at times be pretty ordinary, right? So putting people who were traumatised in institutions as children into institutions that, quite frankly, a Royal Commission found have been providing services that cause trauma in their old age, that's about the worst thing that we can do unless those way those services are provided changes dramatically. So the aged care system, for example, needs to adapt its services to be on the terms and in the ways that serve the Stolen Generations people and not actually re-traumatise them the same way as they were traumatised when they were children. And we need to do it now, because this isn't an in-the-future problem. This is a now problem that we have to address.
The statistics that have been released as part of that report and also the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare are damning in terms of the outcomes for people who are particularly over 50 and Stolen Generation survivors. These are numbers in contrast to other First Nations peoples in Australia.
Yes.
And then those are still a disadvantage in comparison to the non-Indigenous members of Australian society. So there's things like having experienced high levels of discrimination, having severe, profound disabilities or poor mental health. The statistics are so much worse for these people. Now, the priorities outlined by the Healing Foundation are reparations now there have been some through state, but an actual national redress scheme to support survivors and their families, as well as those intentional healing centres and support services. Are the mechanisms for those in place that need to be switched on and supported with additional funding, or are they still being defined and refined?
I think it's a patchwork. There are some services that have been developed in different jurisdictions to respond to particular things that are stolen generation peculiar or particular, but overall it's a patchy approach. So there's other things that just need to be designed and developed from the ground up, and certainly there is inconsistency between the states and territories in how they've responded to things. So I think that there really needs to be a national framework of standards in regard of responding to the stolen children. That's certainly something the Commonwealth can lead on. Even if the states have to do the heavy lifting of the actual service delivery, the Commonwealth can at least play a role of A, financial support, but B, having a consistent approach across the country. Because one of the things that is illogical is the inconsistency of approaches between each jurisdiction, when fundamentally these issues are universal across the Commonwealth. There is not a vast difference between people in Western Australia and people in Victoria, or people in Tasmania and people in Queensland. It should be an accepted fact that stolen generations people have more severe disadvantage or multiplied disadvantage on top of what the broader Aboriginal community has, which is on top of what the wider community has. So I think that that approach of the Commonwealth setting a standard that is to be expected, that's what needs to be done. That should be undertaken as a matter of urgency, in my view.
For those of us who've been following Indigenous affairs, perhaps a concept of what exactly intergenerational trauma is has been already made very clear. But for those who haven't got a clear understanding of that, I think this report highlights it more comprehensively than others that I've seen, in terms of it's breaking down the percentages of descendants of stolen generations children who are living in each state, from approximately 63% in, I think, WA, closer to 50% in South Australia, and I think it goes down to around 40% in other states, but still a significant number of people living in those communities have experienced this disconnect from culture and family, who have dealt with this trauma, and there are those repercussions. The report says that attending to that has to also be a priority. What systems need to be in place there? What priorities need to be put in place to help those people?
I think that's something which the report does really well. It actually gives a number which is critically important in developing responses or policy approaches to these problems, is actually understanding the scope of the problem. So 142,000, I think, the figure is in the report. What's happened is, because these removal of children, it's not only affected those who are taken, but it's created this ongoing cycle of the generation that comes next inherits the issues of the generation before. So at its simplest, the people who were taken, the children who were stolen, were not given the opportunity to have a childhood, and they've grown up under trauma and distress and having great difficulty with a lot of just ordinary life outcomes. Their children have grown up in the environment of a parent that struggles, and then they struggle themselves when they're parents, and then those children, the children of those people, struggle with their own children. So that's like four generations there inheriting the trauma and stress. We have to have programs and projects and things in place and services which do things to ameliorate the effect of that passing down of those difficulties to the next generation. No parent wants their children to live the same worst of their life that they did, you know. But people need support to help that happen. I think one of the great challenges, though, is it's been like a tsunami down the generations. How do we stop that tsunami continuing? That's the real challenge. And so we need things in place which help people be the people they want to be, not just the people they are, and recognise that it's taken generations for this to go all horribly wrong. It may take a number of generations to get this back on a level keel again. This isn't an instant fix. This isn't a set of one-off programs that will fix everything. This is fundamentally shifting how people see themselves, how they relate to not only the people around them, but the people who are yet to come after them, their children and their grandchildren and their great-grandchildren. That's the sort of thinking or structural approach we need to this. And the types of services, for example, how do we help people learn to become the parents that they want to be instead of the parents that they are? That's really difficult and hard, but it's doable. But we need to do it with the people who this is about, not impose something on them that they've not been part of the development of. Otherwise, that will achieve nothing and will just waste a whole bunch of time, money and effort.
Yesterday at the National Press Club, Fiona Cornforth, the CEO of the Healing Foundation, made a statement that unique to Australia's First Nations culture is the ability to heal. And it seemed like that priority was at the basis of all of the recommendations that come out from this particular report. What's your response to that statement?
Yeah, and thinking of it as healing is actually a really good way of defining what we're trying to achieve, because we want people to heal because they're hurt, they feel damaged, they feel broken, but we need to help them heal to find a place in their lives where they feel okay, where they feel good about their life. And that can only come through that broad concept of healing, which is how you regard your whole life, not just the bits and pieces of it, but your whole life. So I think saying that we have a unique focus on healing because we look at the whole person, not just bits of the person, that is an Indigenous way of looking at things, which fits with our bigger cultural view or conceptual framework of how we look at the world, is we look at the whole, not just the bits and pieces that constitute it. And so this fits with that concept of healing. To heal the individual, that means to look at the whole of the individual, which will then you look at to heal a community, you look at the whole community, not just the broken bits, but you uplift the whole community. And that helps uplift the broken bits as well. You look at the whole of us as a people and you look to uplift all of us, not just some of us. And then that's how healing occurs.
Ian Hamm, Yorta Yorta man and chair of the Healing Foundation's Stolen Generation Reference Group. And we'll pop a link to the report on the WIRES website. I encourage you all to have a look.